This week saw the continuation of a cherished tradition in our country, the peaceful transfer of power, after a wee bit of a hiccup a couple weeks back. But now, to quote Nina Simone by way of John Legend, it's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life. But are we feeling good? That is the question we're exploring in this week's episode of the Information's 411. In the first half, we're looking at the relationship between the tech industry and the press that covers it. Zoe Bernard broke a story for us that looked at how high-profile VC firm Andreessen Horowitz is expanding its media ambitions and building out a new opinion section as the company increasingly tries to go direct, as they say. It wants to cut out the press and let the partners and portfolio companies speak directly to the public. Another reporter who covered the story is Eric Newcomer. Eric was actually an early Information employee, and now he's doing the Substack thing with his newsletter, Newcomer.co, which covers the VC space. We all chatted about why relations between the tech press and the VC world have grown frosty. Then I chatted with Corey about his story on Airbnb, which, another tech company that is also trying to deal with white supremacists. Corey explained how Airbnb is ensuring that renters with racist or offensive views get booted off the platform, and why they're being even more restrictive than Facebook on that front. It is fascinating. But first, let's dive into the media and VC world. All right, so earlier this week, Zoe, you published a story that kind of dug into the next step of Andreessen Horowitz's media plans and where they want to take that branch of the VC firm, which is kind of a funny thing to even talk about. And then Eric, you explored that topic in your newsletter, but you also gave this kind of longer overview that basically explains like the history of VC media relations over the past 5 years or so. So Zoe, maybe we'll just start with like the news that you were writing about. I mean, explain to me what Andreessen plans to do with like the next wave of hires and their quote unquote media arm.
So they're bringing in a couple of editorial roles under the marketing branch, and it's going to be overseen by Sunil Choksi, who was a former opinions editor over at Wired Magazine. Her role is overseen by Margaret Wenmacher, who's just, kind of a legendary figure in Silicon Valley and in media circles. So it sort of seems like they are moving towards a shift of, as someone put it to me, owned media, not earned media, that they don't maybe necessarily want to be relying on the press so much to get the narrative about Andreessen Horowitz and its portfolio companies out into the public eye. It's representative of this larger shift, it seems, in venture capital circles, where there just seems to be a lot of animosity towards the media and to, you know, wanting to present a different view that's maybe more pro-tech.
Right. And it obviously comes in the midst of what you described as, like, I guess, some level of animosity. And I never know how, I mean, I don't know. I talk to a lot of VCs. I don't think, at least when they're talking to me, how much they hate me. Maybe they do. But, you know, there's just, I guess, this increasing sense that the tech press is out to get tech companies, that we're no longer interested in writing about the good stories and all the positive things they do in the world. And instead, we only want to cast it in this negative light. I mean, Eric, is that basically the frame that a lot of VCs have these days?
I mean, I think Andreessen Horowitz is in many ways a unique firm, because part of what I outline is, you know, they came into Silicon Valley when, you know, the Sequoias and Benchmarks of the world were much more in control, much more reticent to sort of share things with the media and keep them in the loop. And Andreessen Horowitz and their fixer, Margaret Wenmachers, you know, really sort of built close relationships, sort of managed the flow of information about their portfolio companies, got a bunch of magazine profiles. You know, that was sort of the mission of Andreessen Horowitz. And now that they've built their reputation in the media and the media has turned sour on the technology industry, they're going their own way.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think it was inevitable? I mean, the way that you kind of are describing it now, it sounds like this was all part of the plan. Like, you know, maybe if the media didn't go as sour on tech as you frame it, this didn't need to happen. But it also just seems like if you're a VC firm, you want total control, right? You want to make sure that everything that is written about your investments and the firm itself comes out, making it look as positive as possible.
It's hard to say, you know, what would have been if the media was different. I mean, I do think sort of there's certainly a world where you have both content marketing and a direct relationship with the media. I mean, that's what most companies and venture firms do. I write content marketing, the idea that a business is putting out its own information to try and attract customers or founders or whatever your strategy is, isn't new. What's new is the amount that Andreessen Horowitz wants that content to really be sort of the sole way of communicating with the public. And, you know, there are exceptions, but that's really the strategy. And I think that's what's exceptional about this.
I mean, Zoe and Eric, both of you guys have written stories that I'm sure VC firms and founders, whoever, would consider critical pieces, right? I mean, like Zoe, you wrote about Kleiner Perkins and some of the interpersonal struggles they had there. And Eric, you've written Zenefits, for example, and looking, which is, you know, an Andreessen company that was a catastrophe. I mean, as you wrote these pieces, which all came out a couple years ago, what was the response you got at the time? And did you start to feel that there was like this rising frustration on the part of investors or other people in tech saying like, God, you guys are just always looking out for the negative story? I mean, what do you think, Zoe?
I mean, I think it's funny that it's like, I mean, who is leaking these stories? You know, like, who do you think is talking to the tech press?
Right. They hate the press in public and love it in private sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, like, come on, who's talking to journalists? Like, let's get real, right?
I think, I mean, one shortcoming I would say of my piece is just, I didn't resolve the question of whether Andreessen Horowitz's pivot against the media is mostly tactical or mostly a reflection of sort of the political inclinations of like Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz and to some extent Margaret. You know, is it that they just like have been bought into sort of this Trumpian anti-media philosophy that you're seeing with people like Balaji, or how much is it just like a tactical, we're experts in sort of the media and so we're going to build our own operation? I think it's both. I mean, and I sort of leave that open, but I do think that's sort of the question here. How much are they clouded by sort of an anti-media animus? I mean, you listen to some of the things Mark Andreessen says on Clubhouse, or is it really this sort of genius tactical sort of move?
Yeah, it's a tough question to ask you guys because you're obviously, you know, you have your very journalist-focused perspective.
I'm in the tank for reporters.
Yeah, which, yeah. You know, I guess that's, it would be disingenuous for you to claim otherwise even if you wanted to be like contrarian. But do you think, I mean, let's just take on potentially good faith that there are more negative stories being written about tech companies than there were in the past. And if you disagree with me, tell me that. But like, if you think that's the case, what do you think the reason for that is? Is it, like you say, the sources that are coming to speak to us are just more willing to kind of speak out against their companies, or because we just have grown weary of the positive stories and, you know, for us, this is just more, I don't know, exciting. I'm trying to make their case as honestly as possible. But like, what do you think the reason is?
I mean, tech is like the most powerful industry in the world, and it deserves to be scrutinized very closely. I mean, that seems fairly obvious that when we're talking about, you know, companies that like, I don't know, with Facebook, when it first started, you got it's a piddly little company. It doesn't have the sort of outsized impact where now it's like we're influencing elections, you know?
I do think tech is very sensitive. I mean, just covering VCs for a long time, that's sort of a reality. Part of it is that they got these fawning magazine profiles back when it was sort of not seen as influential. And it was sort of more, you know, oh, here are these neat things they're doing. And then clearly tech started getting covered much more like sort of the political world with the intense scrutiny and sense of sort of great power. But then tech still hasn't embraced sort of the norms of the political world where you're like, yeah, it's natural that I be held accountable and answer questions. Like, they don't want to take questions, right? I think that's what reporters are really cheering for. It's like, put questions to the people in power and have them engage with what they're doing. And, you know, both our stories are about Andreessen's media strategy, our source, right? I mean, I say in there that I talked to Margaret for an hour and she refused to be quoted on the record. So that, you know, that's how it is.
Yeah. What do you think, Zoe? I mean, if not specifically about, you know, Margaret and what she's doing with Andreessen, like, have you noticed a distinct shift in the way that the kind of press arms from these VC firms try to, you know, negotiate that relationship with the press?
I mean, it's like, obviously we're talking about such a relatively small pool of venture capital firms that can even do this, you know? I mean, we're talking about like the top tier firms. And I think like the industry wide, I mean, what founder is really going to want a blog from Andreessen Horowitz written about them versus, you know, the New York Times? I mean, what is actually the true validator of success? Like, I think that these VC firms, like, they can go out and they can have this, you know, owned media approach, but I don't know whether or not that is actually going to give a lot of credence to their portfolio companies.
Do you buy this as an actual, like, total approach to how they want to manage a relationship with the press? I mean, if you talk to or you read people like Balaji, never had the pleasure of talking to him, you know, they'll say that there's never a time where any founder or VC firm or whoever needs to ever talk to the press again. We've got our blogs, we've got our media arms, we've got, I don't know, our Twitter accounts that are probably 80% bots.
One point I just want to make, it's like a company like Tanium, right? Very successful, but has had a lot of negative stories written about, huge in the Andreessen portfolio. It's like, it's almost hard for that company to go to the press and give an interview without facing questions about past reporting. And so then if you have your own media ecosystem, you can sort of draw attention to that company without worrying about sort of harsh questions.
Last thing here is, as reporting out this story and talking to people who are involved in this process, did it make you reflect at all on your past reporting and whether you feel like you, you know, had taken a turn to being more reflexively critical because one reason or another? I mean, you know, I'm not saying this is like a threat to our businesses, but just generally, I find kind of one value of reporting on the media is like we all work for media companies to some degree, and it gives you an opportunity to think like, well, how's my business doing? What am I doing? I mean, did you think at all differently about the stories written in the past, or this is just, you know, this is what it is?
Reporter, we were too sort of upbeat about startup. We cared too much about valuations for a period in 2015, 2016, where we wrote a ton about valuations. And I think we downplayed how much making that the story really shaped the narrative about how we thought about unicorns. And we saw ourselves as passive players. And eventually that burned out of our system. I think privately, and then in opinion columns, reporters were too negative about the potential for Silicon Valley, because obviously many of those companies ended up becoming very valuable. So I think there was this weird situation where we got obsessed with a weird type of story we really probably shouldn't have done so much, which was just like valuation, you know, new unicorn. But then on the other hand, I think, you know, this sort of opinion writing should have been much more open to the possibility that a big change was happening.
All right, Eric, Zoe, thank you so much for joining. All right, Corey, so it is inauguration week, time for reflection and looking ahead at what's to come. And you have a story about Airbnb and both looking backwards and forwards at its own issues around content moderation in a different sort, and just who really can get to use its platform. What's going on when it comes to Airbnb and the types of folks who can or can't be participants in its platform?
Yeah, so this was an inauguration under heavy security. It was 2 weeks after the insurrection at the Capitol, and thankfully it turns out there were no major incidents at inauguration, but you know, at state capitals across the country, in Washington, everyone was on very high alert. And what the rabbit hole in reporting that I went down sort of started from a press release, as most good reporting doesn't start from, but it started from a press release a couple weeks ago that Airbnb put out.
Don't give away all your secrets, Corey.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Press release based reporting. That's all I do. There was a line that caught my eye in this press release that Airbnb put out that was sort of trying to unveil their inauguration safety plans. And what they said was, if we confirm that any guests are associated with a hate group or otherwise not allowed on our platform, et cetera, we're going to cancel those reservations and ban them from Airbnb. So this, like, begs the question, like, how do they do that? How do they know when guests are going to be part of a hate group? You know, if you are affiliated with neo-Nazis or white supremacists, you don't really advertise to your Airbnb hosts that you are coming for like a neo-Nazi rally. So how does Airbnb do this? Like, was it just corporate PR, or was there actual teeth to this?
All right. So what did you find out? What is the Airbnb trust and safety team really like?
First, we're going to go back to 2016 because all of this kind of started for Airbnb was sort of the opposite problem. Airbnb first had to deal with this pretty big scandal where there were found to be racist hosts on the platform, not just racist guests, but there were people actually blocking potential guests from coming to their Airbnbs because they were the guests were Black or Asian or people of color otherwise. And this created like a huge storm. It was a corporate nightmare. So to fix the problem, Airbnb introduced some new policies so that hosts couldn't see a guest's race before they booked. So people of color who tried to book wouldn't get blocked. And this meant basically a wider purview for Airbnb's trust and safety team. And I talked to Nick Shapiro, who worked at Airbnb from 2015 to 2019. He was the global head of crisis management. And yes, Airbnb has a global head of crisis management. And here's what Nick said.
Keeping people safe online, and especially at a company like Airbnb that deals online and offline, is critically important. It's critically important to the safety of its users. It's important to the reputation of the company.
So basically, the types of people that are working at Airbnb to make sure that, you know, you as a guest don't get murdered are now also the people that are ensuring that there's no overt discrimination, or if there is a discrimination claims, they have to vet it.
Yeah, so it's both the trust and the safety part. And all of this work became more important a year after 2016 and 2017, where, if you remember, white nationalists were planning a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. It turned out to be really violent. Someone was killed. It was obviously like...
Sure. Good people on both sides is what I remember about that.
Exactly. And it turned out people planning to attend the rally were passing around links to Airbnb rentals that they were renting so that they would have places to stay when they went to this rally. You know, neo-Nazis need a place to put their head at night as well. This generated a ton of bad press for Airbnb, which is a company that's pretty sensitive to bad press. Aggressive PR strategy they have, and I've experienced it firsthand. But in this moment, executives had a debate. Should we ban white nationalists from Airbnb? Can we kick them out of their reservations? How do we do that?
And it was a chance for the company to move from a reactive footing on this issue to proactive and take a leadership role in taking a stand.
So let's go into how they do it exactly, because it sounds complicated, and it sounds like it also requires, you know, probably a lot of company resources to make effective.
Yeah, I think what I was struck by was the work was possible because of they could check what other tech platforms like Twitter and Facebook, sort of what people were doing on those platforms to see who was headed to these white nationalist rallies. Like you had, you know, sort of people giving clear indicators that they were espousing these views and part of hate groups. And that's kind of how this work really started.
We saw people were publicly RSVPing to racist white supremacist events on Facebook and on other platforms. And people were attending these rallies and they were doing news interviews. And we were able to match their names, match their accounts with potential Airbnb accounts. And when we found them, we would remove their booking or prevent them from booking.
Airbnb ended up creating kind of a system for this work. According to people I spoke with for the story, who were both current and former employees, Airbnb has a specialized team of about a half dozen people who will comb through Facebook, Twitter, and far-right online forums and track where rallies are planned. And oftentimes, in order to kind of see what people are talking about, particularly on Facebook, they will create dummy accounts, which are called sock puppet accounts, to monitor customers who are publicly embracing propaganda that could encourage violence. And according to one estimate, this has resulted in the low hundreds of people being banned from Airbnb for their affiliations with these groups.
So how much moderation is too much? I mean, do you have a sense that at Airbnb, while they do care a lot about ensuring that the platform doesn't host hateful people, that there is kind of a, going too far and being so concerned about it that you just end up, first of all, hurting your brand, but also, you know, wasting resources, you know, tracking down every single thing someone said online to ensure that they meet your criteria of a positive Airbnb user?
You know, over the years, Airbnb executives have debated this question. I think there is definitely a camp of people who have raised these questions about, is this creepy? Are we stepping into sort of a Black Mirror or Big Brother sort of role by monitoring other social media sites for what our users are saying or doing? Are we overreaching here? I think these are all reasonable questions that people have been asking inside. But I think, at least for now, and this is what I talked to Shapiro about, they seem to be walking the line fairly well, you know, in terms of the media, society, everyone sort of seems to be pushing more in the direction of taking action. And that's at least, you know, sort of we should be wary of, does this turn into something that oversteps, you know, something that's, you know, where companies are policing sort of behavior that isn't violent or what have you, and it's just more political in nature. But I think for now, Airbnb seems to be walking the line fairly well. And that's at least where Shapiro came down on it.
And I don't think Airbnb is headed in the direction of looking at your Uber rating or your, you know, whether you've been complained about on Yelp. But what Airbnb is talking about is if you are going to publicly discriminate and put out hate towards other people, and it is in a way where Airbnb can find it in a transparent way simply by looking at public statements and news interviews and on Facebook, then they're going to use that information and prevent you from booking. And I think that's the right approach.
All right, Corey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
That's today's episode. Thanks to Zoe, Eric Newcomer of Newcomer, Corey, and Nick Shapiro. Take it easy, everyone. See you back here next week.